You think it's just a malicious attack on Bitcoin?
It's definitely a malicious attack at this point. The people that have basically taken control of the GitHub project are bad actors. They are not looking out for Bitcoin's interests. They have some ulterior motive.
Now, to me, that doesn't make any sense why you would be involved in a project if you were actively trying to sabotage it. For what reason?
You can't sabotage a project unless you get involved in it.
True.
The immediate danger is the illegal data problem, which has been created by Core 30, actively making it easier to spam and making it a supported use case.
Bitcoin isn't intended to be a file sharing network. What is Bitcoin supposed to be? What is spam? Can you define spam?
Anything that people have not consented to. When you run Bitcoin, you're running it for a specific purpose, and there's only one purpose that was there intended from the start that everyone has agreed to. Calling it censorship to keep Bitcoin what it's supposed to be and stop attacks is nonsense. The way Bitcoin works is that the nodes are the ones enforcing the rules. If you're not running a full node, you're not verifying that according to those rules they paid you. You think that they paid you when they haven't. If you're not enforcing the rules, nobody is. People need to actually choose to run a full node. A lot of people today don't even have a computer, they just have a phone. They're not going to have a full node on their phone at this point. Back then, people were running full nodes on their phone, but it's only gotten harder and harder because the block size is such that the blockchain grows faster than the technology is keeping up with improving on processing that data.
If we went down to what number, would you be like really concerned about it?
I'm really concerned about it already. I mean, it was 200,000 back in 2017. The highest it's been recently is 100,000. It wasn't really until COVID hit and the government started printing money like crazy that it became clear that if Bitcoin didn't work out, the economy as a whole was not going to work out.
You said that Bitcoin's odds of succeeding as a decentralized currency might be as low as 3-4%. Why are we in that much danger right now?
The probability of success is low, but it's there. I'm working as hard as I can to get Bitcoin to meet that small probability.
Down a rabbit hole. Down. Cypherpunk. Rabbit.
Welcome back to Cypherpunked, where we explore money's history, crypto's future, and Web3's role in advancing human rights, freedom, and digital liberty. Today's guest is Luke Dash Jr., one of the longest tenured Bitcoin Core developers, contributing since 2011. He is the creator and lead maintainer of Bitcoin Knots, an alternative Bitcoin node implementation focused on decentralization, user sovereignty, and resisting protocol abuse. Luke is also the CTO and co-founder of Ocean, the Bitcoin mining pool designed to return block construction to individual miners and reduce systemic mining centralization. Luke played a critical role during the 2013 Bitcoin chain split, helping guide the network away from an unnecessary hard fork that could have permanently fractured Bitcoin. He has been described by peers, including Jack Dorsey, as a guardian of Bitcoin and is known for his uncompromising defense of Bitcoin as decentralized, censorship-resistant, sound money. Welcome to the show, my man.
Thanks.
So, Luke, tell me about yourself. What did you do before Bitcoin? Like, what was your early life like? How did you even get involved in?
Before Bitcoin, I kind of came to Bitcoin from the open source side. I've been involved in open source for a long time. I did some work on BitTorrent clients and other file sharing network stuff. Did some work in telephony systems.
What do you think about this, the idea of open source projects versus closed source, like this idea of the cathedral? The bazaar.
Cathedral versus the bazaar is more about centralized versus decentralized development. But as far as I'm concerned, closed source basically doesn't exist.
Okay, that makes sense. Have you ever seen that? I was looking at the other day because I was interested just to see how Bitcoin has evolved as an open source project. And there's like this really cool video that just shows all of the code commits. I think it was made like in 2017, like it ends in 2017, but like it shows from the beginning of the Bitcoin to 2017, and it just shows how the network evolves and it like has all these little dot points. It's really cool. And I saw your name on there a lot, like moving in, coming back, coming out. It was like really, really interesting to visualize the creation of like an open source project with all of these random people that are coming, and some people coming 3 years later, some people coming 7 years later, some people, you know, coming for 1 year and disappearing, and then, you know, people coming in and out and back. It was just like, it was really interesting to visualize that. Do you, when you think about closed source projects, is there any positive reason to have a closed source project, or would you say that all projects should be open source, or it really depends on what you're trying to build?
Yeah, everything should be open source. If you don't have the source code, how can you ever trust it?
Okay, that makes sense. I think the the counter argument from the closed source community would be, or people that have closed source stuff would be, we don't want someone to steal our code, or we don't want someone to find a hack in the code or something along those lines.
People who are trying to compromise programs can do it with or without the code. Mm-hmm. It's really just the defenders, the good actors who mm-hmm. are kind of put at a disadvantage by not having access to the code.
Can you unpack that a little bit?
The attackers are used to working with closed source things. They're used to looking at the low-level assembly code, the bytecode, the way the CPU works with it, just in the closed source program. They don't, I mean, they gain probably a little bit of benefit from having source code to review, but not nearly as much a benefit as the people who would find the vulnerability and fix it.
Interesting. Yeah, it's that the more eyeballs. What was the, there's a great quote, I think it's by Linus, like, with more eyeballs, all bugs are shallow, or something like that. Do you know what I'm talking about? The
no.
quote? No? there's some quote that I think Linus Torvalds said that was like, with enough eyes, all bugs are shallow, or something like, it was something to the extent of what you were just describing right there. As far as all the projects you've worked on, do you, obviously Bitcoin is your most passionate project that you've seen. What did it feel like when you discovered Bitcoin? Did you instantly realize the significance of what Bitcoin was, or was it kind of like, oh, here's something interesting? Is it like similar to BitTorrent or other open source projects? Or were you like kind of, wow, this is amazing? Did you have that?
No, actually, I saw Bitcoin as kind of just a nerdy experimental mm-hmm. project to, mm-hmm. you know, advance the ability to use non-decimal number systems with currency. It wasn't really until COVID hit and mm-hmm. the government started printing money like crazy that it became clear that if Bitcoin didn't work out, the economy as a whole was not going to work out. We'll have some dark years ahead if we don't make
Interesting.
It work.
I mean, it was like I did a book series with Larry Laporte and we talked about his book, The Big Print. And then, like, if you look at the data over, you know, the past century or whatever, it just seems like every time there's an issue or problem, the printers fire up and it just gets bigger and more adamant, like more pronounced. Like, I think with COVID, it was like 50% of all the dollars that have ever existed, you know, in 120 years, they've made in like 4 months or something crazy.
Yeah, I think we went down a path we're not going to ever return from on the US dollar. It's pretty much a guaranteed failure at this point. It's just a matter of time.
Matter of time. So obviously the history of all fiat currencies have essentially ended in failure, right? I mean,
right.
So
I don't think there's any doing good at this point.
Yeah, what you just said is, you know, it's not the exception. It's literally the rule. I mean, the exception is a fiat currency that lasts for a very long period of time, because the world reserve currency, at least for sure, you know, has always changed hands. It's always, you know, been different as time goes on, and usually fiat currency failure is the product. Once you get humans in that loop that can kind of arbitrarily make decisions, especially if they don't have to bear the consequences of those decisions. The way I think about money printing is like, it's like doing drugs. It's like you feel great right away, but then you get all the consequences a little bit later that are delayed, that are way worse than had you just not done drugs.
I'll have to take your word for it.
Well, I don't do drugs, but I'm just throwing it out there. I'm just throwing it out there as an analogy, right? Oh, man. So, obviously, you worked with Core for a very long time. What made you decide to start a separate implementation? And, you know, when did you decide that you couldn't work with Core anymore? I mean, can you talk about that a little bit?
I mean, Bitcoin Nuts began pretty much the same time Bitcoin Core began. Mm-hmm. They've been peacefully coexisting in parallel for mm-hmm. 15 years now or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And to an extent, I still work with Core to the mm-hmm. extent that the gatekeepers let me.
The gatekeepers. So can, like, for our non-technical audience, can you explain a little bit like how that would work? Like, you can run us, you're running Nonce at the same time, but you're also, you know, pushing things to Core as well. You guys are kind of sharing ideas. I mean, just unpack that a little bit. I'm not technical at all, and most of our audience probably is not either.
Both Bitcoin Nonce and Core are based on the code that Satoshi released mm-hmm. way back when, and so the code bases are almost identical, really. Nonce usually rebases on and pulls in everything Core does, every release usually. And so they remain very similar. The only difference is that Knots has usually more features, more fixes merged than Core does.
Interesting. Let's talk a little bit about the idea of, because I know this has been a big controversy, obviously, with Knots and Core, the idea of using Bitcoin block space for non-monetary things, transactions that are non-monetary in nature. How do you like, with somebody who's not technical, like my first thought was, oh, if somebody pays, they should just be able to put whatever they want on Bitcoin because the fee is the filter, right? That's like the way that I always thought. As I learned more, now I'm not so sure. As I watched a lot of debates play out, my mind's been changed a little bit on some of these issues. Satoshi, I mean, on the very first block he ever pushed through on the blockchain, there was non-financial information on there. I know there's different ways you can put information on chain. You can put it in the block header, or you can put it actually in the transaction. Can you like explain that a little bit, like in layman's terms for people?
I mean, Bitcoin is not a storage system. It's not designed for that. It's not intended for that. It's only the last year or two that people have started trying to exploit it for that purpose. Satoshi's, the Genesis block, uses the Coinbase. Every block has 100 bytes that are reserved for the miner that can be put arbitrary, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 100 bytes a block. That's like maybe a few kilobytes a year. But in the Genesis block, Satoshi used that specifically, one, to make a political statement, obviously, but it also had the parallel purpose of proving that he did not pre-mine Bitcoin.
Mm.
That newspaper headline was the same day he launched the Bitcoin blockchain.
Yeah.
And so anyone could see that he had not mined for months other blocks based on this.
It was kind of like proof of fair mining, launch.
Yeah, basically. Proof that there was no pre-mining at all.
This 100 bytes that's set aside for the miner that publishes, is it possible that, like, are obviously most people are not putting non-financial information in there, or are they using that space to put non-financial information right now?
It's usually used to identify who mines the block.
Uh-huh.
The pools that find the block usually put the pool name in there.
Mm-hmm.
With Ocean, because the miners make their own blocks, they can put other stuff in there.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible to sell that space to make extra revenue as a place to put information, or is that not a thing that occurs right now?
Is it possible to sell? Yes.
It is possible.
Is there a reasonable market for it? No.
No.
I mean, it's very limited space, very small, and there's really not much use for it.
Okay,
historically, back years ago, the pool, Eligius at the time, had like people who were mining on the pool could just suggest things to put in there and it would go in there, but nobody really cared even then.
Yeah, gotcha.
And that was like, no, there was no cost for doing that, and mm-hmm. people still didn't care to really do it. There was mm-hmm. maybe some movie quotes.
Okay, where, like, so now that bit of space is reserved for the miner that mines the block to put information or it's a name, whatever they want to put there. The problem really comes when people are putting different non-financial information inside the block space. That's usually where all the transactions go. Am I understanding that correctly?
I mean, the block space itself does not support arbitrary data. So to do this, they actually have to disguise their arbitrary data as transactions, which obviously it isn't, but they have to convert it into, make it look like it's a transfer from someone to another.
Uh-huh.
They're really just, their intent of this is to take it later and then transform it back into whatever image or whatever. And so this is fundamentally an abuse of the system. And not only that, but it also makes the blockchain larger. The way the changes in SegWit were made, the block size limit is effectively dynamic. If you have legitimate usage of the chain, it grows maybe 2 megabytes each block.
Mm-hmm.
But the way the spammers are exploiting it, they actually can push that up to like 4 megabytes in the extreme cases.
Is that
what? it increases the load for people to run a full node and also at the same time displaces legitimate usage of the chain. So we've seen a huge drop off of people actually using Bitcoin for transactions and also drop off of full nodes as well.
Do you think that, like, I know correlation doesn't always imply causality. Like, do we think that that is the reason we've seen less transactions, or is it just because Bitcoin seems like it's kind of been in this bearish market for the past couple of years where we haven't got as many people interested in learning about Bitcoin? I mean, I'm just throwing ideas out there. I don't know for sure what the right answer is. I'm just kind of positing a theoretical question.
Well, if you just say hypothetically you wanted to accept Bitcoin, if people can't send you Bitcoins, what's the point? You know?
Yeah.
The fact is the spam has been making it impractical until recently to even send Bitcoin, so people don't even try.
As far as the megabytes go, you mentioned that with SegWit, potentially blocks could be up to 4 megabytes if non-financial information is included in the block. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Yeah. I run nodes for different protocols and projects, and Bitcoin is the lightest node that I run. It's like, I think I'm still running my node on like a 2 terabyte drive that I bought like 8 years ago. So when we talk about making it easy for people to run a node, are you worried that if we go to 4 megabyte blocks that we wouldn't outpace something like Kreider's Law that talks about, you know, how storage space can scale over time? Or is that like a legitimate concern for you? Or you think that it would make it maybe not as easy for people in third world countries? Or like, what's your...
It's not the storage that's the hard part. It's getting the node synchronized and actually processing and verifying all the data. And it was proven back in 2016, 2017 that the network can't actually sustain more than about 300 kilobytes of transactions per block. And despite that, SegWit increased the block size as a kind of compromise with the people that eventually left to make Bcash. But we've seen since that point, the full node count has mostly dropped off. We've seen the negative effects that it's had in practice. So there's really no doubt in my mind there.
So a couple of questions. You said 300 kilobytes. Is that... I'm confused by that. Like, I guess what... my understanding is if I'm doing a new node, like it takes a day to like get it to synchronize, you know, but after it's synchronized, it's fine. Is that what you're talking about here when you say like,
yes,
how long it takes to synchronize? But then once it's caught up, it just runs smooth, at least for me.
It takes a day if you're on a beefy machine, maybe, but a lot of people don't have that. And a lot of people, unfortunately, aren't willing to wait a day.
Yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. They're not willing to wait to synchronize a node.
It's not enough that it's technically possible for people to run a full node. People need to actually choose to run a full node.
Okay.
A lot of people today don't even have a computer. They just have a phone. They're not going to have a full node on their phone at this point. Back in 2013, 2012, that was actually something that you could do.
You could run a full node on a phone, yeah. Really? Yeah. Okay. I have a Raspberry Pi out there that I use.
Yeah. Back then, people were running full nodes on their phone. But it's only gotten harder and harder because the block size is such that the blockchain grows faster than the technology is keeping up with improving on processing that data.
Okay. It's an interesting
thought. one megabyte per block, for example, you multiply that's 144 megabytes a day, times 365 days a year. That's actually growing at a tremendous rate. And the CPUs, the disks only improve so much per year, and that's like,
I guess
that's a 17% improvement on the technology side.
So I was actually researching this a little bit, looking into something called Kreider's Law that was talking about how storage space was improving, and it seemed like it was, from my initial research, that it was greatly outpacing the growth of the Bitcoin blockchain.
It's not the storage space that is the problem, the bottleneck. It's the storage speed.
Storage speed, okay, and that's synchronizing that full node that will take. 17 hours or 16 hours or however it is, depending on what you're using. I think if you're using an SS, I know there's different, again, I'm not a super savvy hardware specialist. I think I'm using an SSD for my node, which is older technology. Now they've got these .2 drives and these things that are, you know, almost some of my computers, I have this little drive that's this big and it's like 3 terabytes or 5 terabytes or whatever, 2 terabytes. And that thing, like that thing, man, that thing goes fast. Yeah, like, the node will synchronize in like 30 minutes or an hour with that. I feel like
there's definitely improvement, but yeah. The blockchain growth has done so much damage already that we have a long way to catch up. We'll probably start catching up in probably within the next decade at some point, but only slowly.
So we want, you know, people to be able to synchronize that node. Your thought is, you know, much quicker than hours or days. We want that to happen faster to encourage more people to run a node. Is there a point of diminishing returns for people running nodes? Is there a number in your mind that mathematically, game theoretically, we want to hit?
Well, for the network to be secure, because we don't have a centralized entity saying this is how it is, the way Bitcoin works is that the nodes are the ones enforcing the rules. And so every time someone pays you with Bitcoins, you are looking at their payment. Does it confirm in the valid blockchain and giving them a product or a service? And so if you're not running a full node, you're not actually verifying the rules. You're not verifying that according to those rules they paid you. They could just be making it. You think that they paid you when they haven't. And so if you're not enforcing the rules, nobody is. And so therefore, usually I would say 85% of the network is where you want to be with safe number of full nodes, you know, weighed by, you know, some businesses do more transactions than other businesses. But if you had a 50-50 split, you could very well have half the economy following an invalid chain where there's been inflation or whatever, the other half the economy following the valid chain. What happens if the valid chain following economy goes to sleep? You got 8 hours on this invalid chain that everyone's following.
Interesting.
And so globally, you need to have enough lead for the valid chain verification to stay ahead of any potential invalid chain that might be mined.
These are interesting topics. My mind's going down all these rabbit holes right now. Oh, it's like, this is like war gaming. Cryptographically.
But cryptography only comes into play if people are actually running the checks.
Yeah. I mean, because I know now, you know, a lot of people just use whatever, they're using hot water on their phone. It's obviously connected to a node that they're not running, right? Most of the time. Most people aren't as technically savvy enough to run their nodes that I know that are using Bitcoin on a daily basis.
And that's a big problem for Bitcoin's security.
What is that? I mean, the thing is too, though, like if you're trusting like a Coinbase or trusting a, you know, third party to run that node, I guess if they break that credibility, do something or get hacked or there's a problem or whatever, then they'll forever lose that credibility. Is there any merit to that as a kind of like a gatekeeping to make sure people are running honestly? Kind of like how when the Silk Road kind of came out, everybody, there was like a rating system, right? Like nobody really knew each other. There was no way to like verify or get your money back or anything, but the ratings were the social consensus was based off of the ratings.
If there's a niche that's relying on one of these trusted entities, yes. Mm-hmm. But if it's suddenly the entire economy, is the entire economy going to give up the last day of their income to enforce the rules? Or are they going to say, no, we need that income. We're going to stick it to the invalid chain and just delete the inflation or whatever. Because at that point, you might get back to a chain that's has the properties you want, but now everybody who was running full node is screwed because they would not have followed that chain. And you eventually end up back to the point where you just, the miners become, and the miners and the exchanges essentially become a Fed without any kind of accountability to anyone.
I know a while ago you actually had put JPEGs on the blockchain. Like, what changed your mind on all of this?
That's not true at all.
Oh, it's not true.
Okay. No.
Tell me what happened. Curious.
I don't know what you're referring to.
Someone said that you had put JPEGs on the blockchain before and then
someone's lying to you.
Someone's lying? That's what I thought you had just like changed your mind, like you put Jesus JPEGs or something on the blockchain, and then later on you're like, no, this is wrong. No, that didn't happen.
No.
Maybe that was just I had read that somewhere, but maybe it was just fake FUD or whatever. I think you've said that Bitcoin's odds of succeeding as a decentralized currency might be as low as 3-4%. Why are we in that much danger right now? Is that just hyperbolic talk, or trying to get people to focus on an issue?
Like you said, people who are using Bitcoin are using a phone wallet and probably not using their own full node. Mm-hmm. We're already in a situation where Bitcoin is left insecure to a large extent.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow we need to get back to that point where people are using full nodes if we want Bitcoin to succeed. And that's definitely an uphill battle.
Yeah, no, for sure. Sure. I think that the entities, I mean, the good part is the entities that do run the nodes, they have a huge incentive to make sure that those nodes are running correctly, following the true chain and doing.
Do they?
I think they do because of just for many reasons. Obviously, social credibility, business credibility. If you're operating and you care about Bitcoin, if you're using Bitcoin, if you're promoting Bitcoin, if you're a Bitcoin company, you know, if Bitcoin fails and it's your fault, I mean, you're basically you're shooting yourself in the foot.
You know? Unless you stand to gain more from Bitcoin's failure because you're invested in scam coin.
I feel like you can do both. You can care a lot about Bitcoin and still, you know, be involved in other coins or projects or whatever. You know, I don't think they have to be mutually exclusive. Like
maybe I'm just thinking back to 2017. You had at the time pretty much most of the major exchanges signing onto the New York Agreement, planning to change Bitcoin without any kind of community support for this. And if people were not running full nodes, that can very well happen. And the only reason
that is the beautiful part though about Bitcoin though is like those entities, if they're running one node, they only have one, like it might be an important node, but they only have one vote. So like all the other people can basically use their nodes as a voter, right?
Only if they have a full node themselves. If they're trusting someone else's full node, then they're
I see what you're saying. But what I'm saying is like, yeah, there's say this huge pool running, a node, and then there's Coinbase running a node, and then you, me, and Paul each have a node. Our full node votes counts just as much as Coinbase's node. And
no, we have very little economic influence individually. How often do people pay you with Bitcoins? Not every day, right?
No, not every day, but don't
Coinbase
we,
does.
But don't we have? But our node still has a vote because we still have to, do consensus, right?
Only to the extent that you're accepting payments with Bitcoin and using your full node to verify it.
Okay.
And these centralized exchanges do a lot more of that than most individuals.
Okay. Interesting.
And so if they were willing to try to change the protocol back in 2017 when there were still enough full nodes to say, no, we're not doing this. If people stop running full nodes altogether, as we're heading trending toward, and they can get away with it, wouldn't they?
So are you saying that we've gone down to less full nodes since 2017 to today, or have we gone up? I feel like we have.
2017
to...
was our...
Really?
We have gone up.
Awesome. Okay. Let's see here. So it says the number of Bitcoin nodes has not gone down overall since 2017. In fact, they've shown periods of increase in fluctuation, but key metrics indicate growth and stability in recent years, depending on the type of node counted. There are two main ways Bitcoin node counts are tracked, and they measure different things. Reachable/listening nodes, publicly connectable full nodes, often tracked by bitnodes.io and coin.dance. These are the ones that accept incoming connections and help relay data. That is the most commonly cited visible network metric. In late 2017, during the peak bull run, around 20K, reachable nodes peaked at around 12,000 to 12,500. They dipped in 18-19 down to 9,000. By 2021, they hit new all-time highs above 13,000, 13,374 reported in July 2021. More recent data up through 25 and 26 shows reachable nodes typically in the $10,000 to $15,000 range with ongoing fluctuations, but no sustained long-term decline below 2017 levels. What do you think about that?
Not accurate.
Not accurate.
The 2017 peak was over 200,000 nodes.
Oh, okay. So so total full nodes, including non-listening, unreachable private nodes that still fully validate but don't accept inbound connections. These are harder to count precisely, but are estimated higher, often via crawlers like Luke Dash Jr.'s. There you go. The estimates around 2017-2018 peaked over 200,000 total nodes at one point. There was a notable decline reported in 2019, 2020, dropping below 47,000 in some estimates. And then by 2023 and later, total validating nodes were estimated closer to 50 to 100,000 plus, with some community figures suggesting even higher for private unreachable ones. Okay, so what is the difference between, can you unpack for our like non-technical listeners the difference between both of those nodes that were described there?
It's not a material difference.
It's not a material difference?
Right.
Okay.
It's just that the listening nodes are easier to count than the non-listening ones.
Okay.
But as far as consensus goes, they're identical.
Okay. So why is the count so much higher or so much lower for those listening nodes? Can you go up, Paul, to the top again? Let's see. It was the reachable listening nodes. It's the count seems way lower for those.
Right. You have to basically either have the right ISP, the right router, or manually configure your router or do something to become a listening node. Okay. It takes actual action.
So that's why there's less of those.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's not much benefit to doing so.
So those are not more important for any reason. So, okay. All right, cool. I was going to say.
I mean, we do need some percent of the network using listening nodes, but.
Yeah, because mine is definitely not that.
it can be much smaller. It doesn't have to be 85% of the network listening.
Okay. Well, Brock still has a lot to learn. So do I. Okay, that's interesting. All right, so, you know, I guess my question would be, what number would greatly concern you? You know, if you saw that number that's fluctuated, it seemed to be fluctuating between 50,000 and 200,000 over the past, you know, 5 to 10 years. If we went down to what number, would you be like really concerned about it?
I'm really concerned about it already.
You're really concerned about it right now.
Yeah. I mean, it was 200,000 back in 2017, but it hasn't been since then. It's probably hit the highest it's been recently is 100,000. And despite during all of this, the number of people acquiring Bitcoins, potentially using Bitcoins, has been going up, aside from spam filling the usage. Mm-hmm. But it's still a lot more people are acquiring Bitcoins.
It's hard to know, though, because aren't a lot of people using Lightning Network? So even though, like, if transactions on mainchain have gone down, more people are using. It seems like Lightning has
definitely
picked up,
been
taken
helping.
Some of that. Yeah.
And it also helps on the full node front because you only need to have your full node syncing when you're verifying a new new channel. Mm-hmm. So once you've verified the channel, you have to have some level of monitoring, but it can be like outsourced safely, and you don't have to have a full node syncing constantly anymore. So that does help there, but not necessarily enough to overcome the negative trends.
An optimist. I think we're doing good. I think we're going to keep getting better, and you know there will be challenges and tribulations, and but I think global adoption, people using Bitcoin, people taking advantage of the, you know, the properties and characteristics, although we still have a lot of work to do, I think that, you know, more and more people are learning about Bitcoin and why it's important, getting involved, owning a piece of Bitcoin, you know, getting involved with a network, coming to conferences like the ones we're going to be speaking at in the next couple of days. So,
yeah, don't get me wrong. I would say the probability of success is low, but it's there. And I'm working as hard as I can to get Bitcoin in to meet that small probability.
I mean, 3 to 4% here, if that's what you said, that's pretty low probability of success.
I'm sure I'm not alone. There's lots of other people that are also working hard. So
are you still think 3 to 4% is an accurate number, or would you say more 20% now, 50%?
I say single digit. I don't really
You're still single
specific
digit.
Single digit.
What do you think is the biggest danger right now?
Quick break to support the show. We'll be right back.
So much of what happens is underground. Secret marketplaces and their secret group chats, and there's a huge information asymmetry. If you go into it and you just, you know, try to figure it out for yourself, like, you're going to get burned dramatically because it might take you 4 years to find that where everything is really happening.
The cost to mine one Bitcoin is much less than the purchase price of a Bitcoin. In every project, we look at that. So it's a matter of the energy costs and the efficiency of the miners that we're using. We look at the cost to mine a Bitcoin. They're averaging around $40,000 to $50,000 per Bitcoin is the cost of production. And we're trading at, $110,000 per Bitcoin right now. That arbitrage is what creates such interesting return on investment.
Our business model essentially is, hey, we have the experience. We've already made the mistakes. We can just leapfrog all of that and can work with you essentially and just manage and do everything. And, you know, you're kind of a silent partner, a majority partner, and we're the minority partner, but we're the manager.
You only make money when your partners make money.
There's no fees. There's no this, there's no that. It's like, hey, we're going to negotiate because we're a true partner. And like, we want to make as much revenue as possible because we make our profit solely from net profits of positive cash flow and operations.
Curated mining. Form your own Bitcoin mining company.
All right, let's get back to the conversation.
The immediate danger is obviously the illegal data problem, which has been created by Core 30. Long term, it's definitely getting users to use their own full nodes. I mean, that's kind of, they're kind of interrelated. Yeah. But
I know, you know, I was very skeptical of that problem, but I saw, you know, a lot of good conversations on X. I have a lot of respect for Nick Szabo and his thoughts on the matter. And I saw you guys talking about it. And I was really, you know, reading a lot of the threads and posts on the topic. I'm kind of like right now, like my mind is like undecided. I'm like, I'm up in the air. I've seen so many good threads from both sides of the argument. That's like, I don't know what to believe anymore. So like, I don't know where to.
Just look at, think about yourself. You run a full node. Mm-hmm. If that running a full node required you to be involved in distribution of these illegal materials, not just illegal, but very immoral materials, would you do it?
Would I do it? I mean,
let's pretend it was all legal. Would you willingly distribute stuff?
No, I don't want to distribute that shit. But, you know, it's kind of like, it's almost like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It's like, at running Bitcoin and giving the world an access to money does so much more good than harm, you know, to a decentralized, you know, global money that nobody can, no government can steal from you. Nobody can take away from you. I mean, I don't pay attention day to day with my node. You know what I mean? It just runs. Mm-hmm. And like, I know I'm running Bitcoin. Like, I'm not concerned with individual transact. I don't think about that stuff. You know what I mean? I'm a radical cypherpunk, man. I probably would I would keep running my fucking node no matter what, you know, because I think the mission that Bitcoin fucking represents is so fucking important, and it's such a big deal, and it's so important for humanity that, like, you know, no one's going to destroy that for me. I mean, I'm just saying what I would do, what I'm thinking, like what I'm throwing out there. But, you know, then
Do you think most people that we hope adopt Bitcoin would agree with that?
I don't know. Maybe not. I mean, maybe, you know, I like
it. We're already having trouble. Interesting. Remember, we're already having trouble getting people to run full nodes just because it takes a day or two to sync.
Yeah.
Minor inconvenience.
Do you have, like, I guess I'm trying to pin you down on, like, a number of nodes, like a specific number. Like, you know, if you drop 10,000, like, that would be obviously a cause for extreme concern. Like, what's that number?
Can't have a count because the number of people acquiring and using Bitcoin is changing on a regular basis. Uh-huh. So that's why I would say it's 85% of people doing economic activity with Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that. What the actual count is for 85%, and that's obviously going to continually be increasing as long as we're getting more adoption.
Hmm. Interesting. These are interesting questions. I think, you know, Nick wrote, made some really interesting legal points about, you know, different jurisdictions, and then I saw other lawyers on the other side get involved and say stuff. I think Joe Carlisari had some interesting points, and it's like, it's fascinating to see so many great ideas and people having different thoughts. And like, I just feel happy to be alive at this time to like just witness this all play out and just see, like, I think X has become, you know, like the new Bitcoin Talk forum, it feels like, where everybody's just posting threads and ideas and conversations, and you know, we can go back and forth. And I think I was talking to Nick on one thread, and I don't know if you were on it or not, but what about this? I think we came up with an idea that I thought was interesting that I want to talk to you about and maybe unpack it more. What if there is a way to have not just one type of node, but like a node that can basically not store any of the arbitrary data and store only the financial data, so it's never at risk for any of this? Like, what if there was a bucket? I don't fully understand how these OP, like these different protocol features work, where my understanding is Core V30 wants to create a separate area for this stuff. Is that accurate with the...
No,
it's not accurate.
Adam Back's idea.
That's Adam Back's idea. Okay. So Adam wants to create a separate area to put that information and make it easy to put it there. But what if you could do that and then make it so that you could run a node that doesn't store any of that information? Like the financial incentives would be.
You have to have the spammers voluntarily cooperate with it.
But wouldn't they want to do that because it's cheaper?
Their whole goal is to harm Bitcoin.
So you're saying an attacker, you know, that is not motivated by monetary economic game theory, they would just want to try to harm Bitcoin or attack Bitcoin. They would just ignore to put a cheaper transaction.
I mean, altcoins already exist.
We say that one more time.
Altcoins already exist that are specifically designed for data storage.
Yeah. So, I mean, that is another very accurate point as well, is that, and I, this is part of where like my final thought on all this is that it doesn't matter because at the end of the day, you know, people are going to put it on the other chains just because it's cheaper. But then what you're saying is that they would have a malicious reason not to do it, where it would be non-financial in nature.
I mean, some of the core spammers have as much as admitted it explicitly.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean as much as admitted? Can you unpack that?
They've been interviewed and explicitly said that their goal is to harm Bitcoin.
What? What? Who has said this?
I don't know. Different people in the spam community.
That are Bitcoin core developers?
Not Bitcoin core developers.
Oh, I was about to say.
Spammers.
Although spammers,
Bitcoin core developers have said pretty terrible stuff too, but not.
I mean, I hope they would not be trying to purposely harm Bitcoin. I just, you know, I guess the question is, if Bitcoin can't be censorship resistant and just kind of operate and run, you know, if there is a way, again, I still think that the chance of anything, you know, of Bitcoin not working at this point, I feel like Bitcoin has reached escape velocity. That's my personal opinion, you know, but like Bitcoin has to be able to handle all these challenges and deal with all these challenges. And the question is the network robust enough? I think it is. I think that there's so many nodes distributed in so many different countries and so many different places all over the earth that, you know, it's kind of like people downloading file sharing on the internet. Like, okay, technically it's illegal. Good luck enforcing it at scale across the world. You know, that's kind of my thought. Like, okay, maybe you can make an example out of a couple people running a node. But
well, keep in mind, like, file sharing isn't really illegal. It just allows the copyright holder to sue you. If the government doesn't, the government's not going to prosecute you for it unless you're in Japan.
They have those videos where it says FBI will come after you or whatever.
If you do it commercially.
Or something like this.
If you do it commercially, then you have more liability, but
I feel like I remember some grandma like getting arrested by by the feds or something that when she was downloading files off LimeWire or something way back in the day.
Like I know in Japan they do have criminal penalties just for normal copyright infringement, and people basically don't do file sharing there because they'll go to jail.
Really? Wow. These are interesting conversations and topics. A lot of interesting rabbit holes to go down. And what I mean,
one thing that reminds me of someone trying to argue that the legality of this stuff doesn't matter because Bitcoin's illegal in China and people still run nodes there. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, people don't run nodes in China. You can't run a node in China at this point.
So, can't you use a VPN or something?
I mean, I'm sure there are people who do it anyway, but. For the most part, you know, anyone off the street, even if they want to, they're not going to run a node.
Yeah, the average person, unless they're a true cypherpunk committed to the cause. It's
few and far between as far as Chinese nodes. If you look at the network, you look at the regions that nodes are in, there's basically none in China.
Is there a good infographic to look at that to see where all the nodes are?
I'm not sure.
I'm
pretty sure I've seen websites with it, but I don't know.
I know I've seen them before, and they look kind of cool because you can just see the whole world lit up with all these different connections, which is why I think also that, you know, the whole world is hostile. Like, all these countries are hostile with each other. So, like, if one country loves Bitcoin, the other country hates Bitcoin. If one country, you know what I mean? So, like, you've got this kind of this geographical decentralization and arbitrage, where it makes it hard to uniformly enforce the same laws in all these different places, which is,
well,
I think, one of the benefits of Bitcoin.
Bitcoin becomes a file sharing network for things that are universally abhorred.
Yeah. I just, you know, the only thing that would make sense would be to try to harm the network. But I mean, I just, yeah, that's it. Yeah. Okay. That looks pretty cool. Yeah. You can see
it only takes
everywhere. Australia, Russia, South Africa, Brazil, Argentina, Chile. got Hawaii, Canada, Alaska, Iceland. Iceland's got some Bitcoin nodes. Look at that.
Norway, France.
Algeria, Kazakhstan, Ukraine. Yeah, so there's just nodes everywhere all over the world. It's pretty cool.
Just not China.
Just where's China? You got to go. Well, you got to look at China's got pretty lit up on the coastline there. You see that? That's those were all like Shenzhen. You got Taiwan. You've got Japan lit up. I mean, so you got some, you got a lot of Chinese nodes along the port cities and the coastline. Guangzhou, Guangdong, like some of those places, Philippines. I mean, looks pretty. I mean, I want to see that whole map blue, but I mean, that's some pretty nice, you know, distribution there of nodes. I think this, most people are not even aware of this conversation because it's so like niche on crypto Twitter, like in the underground. Most people, you know, that are interacting with Bitcoin or new to Bitcoin or whatever, I mean, they don't understand it on a technical level yet. Like I deal with so many people like that. So many, like the conversation we're having, like 99 out of 100 Bitcoiners I talk to, I wouldn't go that far. I would say, you know, 9 out of 10 Bitcoiners I talk to are not like, they barely would know what Core is. They're like, oh, that's a development team behind, but they're not.
Well, that's
they're
part more of the problem.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, and that's why we're having this conversation. I think it's good for people to be aware of it, but you know, you've got to reach people in phases as they can understand, okay, well, you know, why is Bitcoin important, right? Kind of start with the money thing, and then you can kind of get down into these different issues. But I just think it's really cool that these conversations can kind of play out. And I'm like, you know, one day I wake up and I read a thread and I'm on one side, and then the next day I wake up on the other side, and then the next day I wake up, it's like, and I just kind of like, now I'm just kind of like in the middle, and I'm like, I'm really curious how this plays out. And, you know, I can see merit to both sides, and I can see merit to different ideas on both sides. And, you know, you don't want to censor Bitcoin, but yes, Bitcoin isn't intended to be, you know, file sharing network. And it's a fascinating.
Calling it censorship to keep Bitcoin what it's supposed to be and stop attacks is nonsense.
I mean,
are we censoring when we...
What is Bitcoin supposed to be, right? I guess, what is spam? Can you define spam?
Anything that has not been... that people have not consented to. When you run Bitcoin, you're running it for a specific purpose. And there's only one purpose that was there intended from the start that everyone has agreed to.
Well, if the protocol allows you to do it...
It doesn't. That's why they have to bypass it.
But they're still able to do it.
Only by bypassing the rules.
But if they were bypassing the rules, how could they even do it to begin with? Because the rules on the network allow it to happen.
Software is only so smart.
So what is the solution to fix the software? Like would get consensus from people so that couldn't happen.
Because fixes in knots. Core is just obstinately refusing to fix anything and making it worse. I mean, just real quick back to the previous point though, is it censorship to reject transactions that spend Satoshi's coins without a valid signature?
Say that one more time. Is it
if you reject a transaction and keep it out of the chain that has that spends Satoshi's coins but doesn't have a signature, is that censorship?
It's an interesting question.
But enforcing rules is not censorship at all.
I mean, I guess it's your prerogative if you want to do that, I would think. But if the network allows you to not reject those transactions, if a node can not reject those transactions and be in consensus with the network, you know, is if they can do it, they can do it, I guess would be my counter to that. If you can put the next block and you have the right to run whatever implementation you want and do it how you want to do it, that's part of the network, right? I guess, this is an interesting question. It's this interesting thought experiment. I mean, I go back and forth. I just don't think it's for 99% of this what we call spam, you know, putting non-financial information on Bitcoin. I would say that long-term, it does not make economic sense to do that because there are so many other chains where you can do that for so cheap that like trying to put that stuff on Bitcoin is such a niche thing that's like, most Bitcoiners can't afford to even interact with those types of things. So it's like this niche of the niche of the niche thing. And like, I think it just dies out over time. This is just as Bitcoin grows more important for its main use case, it gets more and more expensive to try to put, you know, a picture of a lion or whatever on fucking Bitcoin. It makes no sense. You know, the financial cost is so high that that acts as a filter.
In practice, it's the opposite. The spam crowds out the legitimate usage.
You're saying, but it's so much more expensive to put that spam on there. And if somebody's willing to pay, that's why I get back to this question: is what is spam? I feel like if you ask 10 people, they'll give you 10 different answers. It's almost like this subjective question: is there, what might be spam to you might not, it might be spam to me, but maybe it's not spam to Paul. You know what I mean?
But if it's spam to anyone, it's spam.
Well, what if I say a monetary transaction is spam to me?
You can't, because that was the intended use case from the start. You agreed to that by running the software.
Yeah, but the software is allowing me to do other things.
No,
it's allowing me to do these. What did you call it? I put a Satoshi-less transaction and.
But it does. The point there is the system is based on rules. Having rules is not in any way censorship.
But the rules of the software are allowing this to happen right now. Is there a way to make the rules of the software not allow this to happen?
Yeah, and that's how it has. That's how Bitcoin has worked for the last 15, 16 years.
But haven't people been able to, for the past 15, 16 years, put non-financial information on the blockchain?
No.
I thought this was something that's been happening. This conversation has been happening since Bitcoin's inception almost, of people putting, different forms of arbitrary data on Bitcoin.
Not really.
Not really or not at all?
There's been spam, but when there's a new way of spamming, the bug gets fixed historically.
Okay.
It's not intended use case of it, and there's ways that people can abuse the scripting system to find new exploits to bypass and spam filters.
Then Discord fix those holes historically? Is that how that's happened? Or
used to?
When did that stop?
Last couple of years.
Okay, interesting. So there hasn't been a way for people to put non-financial data for the past 15 years onto the chain that has been unstoppable. I'm over my technical chops here, bro. So you're going to have to bear with me, because I'm not a super technical person, but people that I've talked to have told me that there has been ways to put spam on Bitcoin that have been the same way for a very long time.
Not really. There's been exploits in the last couple of years that Core has refused to fix.
Okay.
That were introduced. Only the Taproot one was introduced in 2021.
So with Taproot and SegWit and all this stuff, like, my understanding was that stuff was introduced to help privacy on Bitcoin. Is that accurate, but also it's introduced ways to exploit the protocol? Is that kind of what you're saying here? So these are unintended.
Taproot has been a significant improvement.
Mm-hmm.
But because the code wasn't updated for it in the spam filter side, the spammers realized they use Taproot, they can just bypass all the spam filters.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's kind of what's allowing this.
Right.
So prior to Taproot, there wasn't a way for spammers to put stuff on that had never been patched.
Can't say there's no vulnerabilities. But
okay.
Until someone exploits it in a systemic way, there's no real reason to proactively go looking for them.
Tell me a little bit about, let's switch gears a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about Ocean. Why did you decide to create Ocean? What is Ocean?
Well, the number two problem with Bitcoin after lack of full node adoption is the terrible mining centralization. Miners are all using pools, and the pools have basically taken control over the whole mining process. So essentially, before Ocean launched, there was 6, maybe 7 real miners that made pretty much all the blocks. And so that is a significant risk for Bitcoin, aside from the full node issue. That needs to be fixed, and that was something that I've actually been in a good position to fix. Maybe one of few people that is in that position to fix. So I figured I should, as long as we need Bitcoin as much as we do, after all the money printing that's been going on since COVID, we're going to have to address this eventually. We might as well get it addressed sooner rather than later. It's just going to get worse and worse. The last 10 years has shown that. And so that's basically why I decided to bring back pool and address the whole mining centralization issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting.
Straight on.
I love it. No, I'm good friends with Bob and Mark, and we've talked a lot about it, and I think it's really cool what you guys are doing. And I know my team and you guys have had a talk. We're going to try to switch over to you guys and make it all work. We just have a lot of, you know, back-end partners that we work with and stuff. So we have to be able to have a, you know, with different business entities, be able to kind of visualize and quickly see through it and kind of have some of that tooling built out around it that, you know, maybe some other pools have. But, you know, I'm 100% with you. I really love the idea that, you know, the miners can produce their own blocks. And I think it's pretty cool how, like, the miners themselves get into the Coinbase when one of them finds a block. I think that's super cool. So it just pays out directly from there. It doesn't, like, go to the pool. Is that my understanding of it? Unless it's a smaller miner.
Yeah.
Because it's not first, but you can only put 50 in there or something like that.
There's some miners that have firmware bugs that limit how many they can put right in the reward. But yeah.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. Very, very, very interesting. My understanding is that you still, like, if the miner finds the block, it doesn't matter what rules they want. You guys will let them do, whether it's, you know, rules from core, rules from knots, rules from however. Is that accurate? Still?
As far as spam filtration goes, yeah.
Spam filtration goes.
Obviously, you have to make a valid Bitcoin block.
Yeah. So So even though you've got a strong opinion on
these issues, you can't mine Ethereum.
Yeah. Well, no longer you can. Oh, man. So as long as, you know.
I mean, we can't stop miners from making whatever blocks they want.
Okay.
It's just impossible.
Yeah.
All we do is help coordinate the rewards.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Okay. I love Bitcoin. It's so the way this all works, it's like you have a strong opinion about something, but at the end of the day, you know, it's decentralized. And, you know, if you solve the block, you get to make the rules and kind of do it within the system, obviously, within Bitcoin's operational system.
Obviously,
as it currently stands.
If a miner is making blocks that are terrible for the network, I'm going to say, yeah, that's a bad thing to do. Mm-hmm. Like, you shouldn't do that. But there's nothing Ocean can do to stop that, even if we wanted to.
Yeah. Well, because what you're doing is you're giving that power back to the miners, right? I mean, that's
the block creation. To be in the first
place. Exactly. Okay. It's just, you know, we've gotten lazy over the past decade.
I mean, if they wanted to, they don't have to use Ocean at all. They could still make that block. There literally is nothing Ocean can do to stop them from making that block.
Okay. Interesting. So I didn't even know about Bitcoin until like 2015. I played sports. I knew not that much about computers, but obviously when I found out about Bitcoin and it's, you know, why I was like fascinated and went down the rabbit hole and studied it. And, you know, in 2013, tell me about this chain split issue that popped up. Like, what almost happened here?
2013 was March and then May. March, I don't know if it was March or maybe even February that Bitcoin Core 0.8 was released.
Mm-hmm.
And that had some major rewriting of basically the low-level backend code for storing the UTXO set.
Mm-hmm.
And when that was rewritten, people didn't realize that there was actually a protocol rule that people didn't know about.
Mm-hmm.
And when they rewrote that code, they accidentally removed the enforcement of that rule.
Mm-hmm.
So the 0.8 nodes that had just come out would now accept blocks that were technically invalid according to the old rules. And that's, if it's intentional, that's a hard fork. if the whole network goes along with it. But because this was completely unplanned, unknown issue, the only real solution at the time was to basically add that rule back in what became 0.8.1. We added the rule back in temporarily and then scheduled a hard fork for 3 months later in May.
Okay.
Coordinated hard fork.
So how did that, was there problems in the short term? Like, how quickly was that second update rushed out?
Well, nobody even noticed that the problem existed.
Oh, nobody.
A miner actually made a block that broke the old rules that had been removed.
Oh, interesting. Wow.
So a miner made that block. The new upgraded nodes accepted the block, and all the old nodes all immediately rejected the block.
So what happened when that occurred?
People noticed somewhat quickly. I guess there was, probably a few hours of analysis of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe even before we had fully figured out what had gone on, the largest mining pool, like the people were actually who ran the pools were actually active in the community at the time. Mm-hmm. And so the largest mining pool just downgraded, and that was enough to resolve the problem because not all the miners had upgraded already anyway. Mm-hmm. So by the largest one downgrading, the old rules had the majority, and then all the nodes followed along the valid chain at that point once they
got ahead. What would happen if something like this happened today? Because obviously the blocks are worth a lot more today. So
yeah,
that's you know, $500,000 block.
It happened today. I don't know. It's hard to say. You would think the precedent would mean everyone would move to the more restrictive rules. Mm-hmm. But it's possible that it could go the other way too. Probably not, though, because I don't think the mining pools upgrade right away. So it would probably be something that got noticed. Obviously, it would get noticed a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
And probably it would get resolved that much faster, I would think.
How would the economic loss to, you know, a party or whatever, how would that be dealt with, do you think?
I don't think it would be dealt with. It'd be just loss.
Yeah, you. Sorry, you didn't really mine this block. Is that kind of how it
that
would
kind
occur?
Of happens occasionally anyway? Is it stale blocks? Sometimes two miners find the same block height at the same time, and only one of them can prevail in the end. So that's just, to an extent, kind of just one of the risks that miners take.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
The sooner miners notice that they're mining invalid blocks, the quicker they can act on it. And
there's been a lot of talk I've been watching on X about filters, this idea of filters. You know, if even if like 5% of the network is running the new Bitcoin Core V30 and 95% would be running knots, that's like one out of every 20 blocks would be put forward by a core implementation that could include a bunch of JPEGs or whatever.
Yeah.
At that point, it would go onto the chain, and then all of the knots nodes would still have to accept that, right? Is that kind of how that works?
Yeah, to a large extent.
To a large extent.
It's still 95% better than the, if it was all the blocks.
Why do you say it's 95% better than if it was all the blocks?
Because 95 out of 100 blocks would not have the spam and would have the legitimate transactions that the spam is.
So, okay, so you're saying that, you know, then it would just be a slower, basically the blockchain would be it would follow the smaller block size and then occasionally you'd have one bloated block, so it wouldn't grow as quickly. I see what you're saying. But it wouldn't solve the, from preventing that from coming on chain, it would just kind of slow it, I guess would be the...
It would rate limit it, and that's really the best you can do with most spam.
Okay. Gotcha. Makes sense. So still a valuable potentiality.
Biggest issue with Core 30 is not so much the spam risk as much as it is the intended data use case, which is what makes the illegal data a problem.
Intended data use case. Can you explain that? Can you say?
Treating data storage as if it's a supported use case and having a specific standard way of doing data storage on the Bitcoin blockchain.
Okay. Interesting.
Because if it's one thing that spammers, like I mentioned, have to like bypass all the rules and find ways to sneak around and like change their data into something else, transactions, and then change it back when they want to look at the data.
Yeah.
It's another thing if Bitcoin itself now supports storing data and they don't have to do anything special. They can just say, we're storing data this way that's now officially standard for the network.
And you're saying, like, in Core V30 made that possible?
Right.
Okay, whereas it wasn't possible before, but it was still happening, it just was harder? Is that my understanding of it?
Before, like, they had to modify their data, hide it as something it wasn't,
okay,
and then change it back later.
Uh-huh.
But with Core 30 now, they can just drop it in the chain, and it's an official supported way of storing data.
So are you talking about, like, before it had to be like a simple proof, like a hash, and then they'd have to take the hash and then convert it back to something else? Is that what you're saying? Or
they would have to take it and make it look like it's payments to someone else.
Okay, gotcha.
Now they can just say, drop it in, this is data storage.
Okay, and I see. I see what you're saying.
That's the only way to see that data. You can't see it as a transaction.
Okay. Is there, I guess I'll go back to that solution that I was thinking of, and that was kind of, you know, brought up a little bit. Is there a way to have two different nodes where you've got this type of node that you can only have financial data, and that the network itself will actively, you know, if you run that type of node, it will prune all of this stuff. And, you know, you can run a full Bitcoin node without having to store any of the arbitrary stuff. And then you can have a secondary, because I know some other blockchains do this where they've got different types of nodes. And
Bitcoin is nodes have supported pruning for years now.
Okay.
But you can't have everyone pruning or the system just doesn't work.
Okay. But I mean, if the core team put it together where, if they made it actually so, you know, there was this bucket where, you know, anything that's non-financial went into this bucket and then everything else went into the main bucket, like, would it be a possible solution to the problem to just have people can choose whether they want to run a node that takes into account everything, or they could run this node that 100% always will enforce none of that.
It would solve the intentional data storage issue. It would not solve the spam issue because it requires the spammers to cooperate.
Okay. But then you could really try to tackle that problem anytime something came up to try to you know, have the core team really focus on that to patch it. Because you were saying before they would historically do that. If there was an exploit that came up, they would fix that in the next release. You could kind of get everybody aligned to say, hey, this part is purely financial, and anytime any kind of spam exploit pops up, we patch it instantly.
I mean, they can already patch it. Mm-hmm. It's just that the people that have taken control of the GitHub project are bad actors. Like, they are not looking out for Bitcoin's interests. They have some ulterior motive.
The people that have basically taken control of Core, is that what you're saying? Or?
Right.
Okay. Who is in control of that right now? And are you just saying that, like, because you disagree with them, or are you saying it because you actually think they're bad people? I mean, can you unpack what you mean there?
I tend to assume good faith as much as I can, but after so many years of this and going in the exact opposite direction, it's really pretty much impossible to assume good faith at this point. There's no explanation other than that they're malicious.
So you are adamant that there's just not a disagreement about the way that things should be run. You think it's just a malicious attack on Bitcoin, or just taking Bitcoin in a direction you don't agree with? I mean,
no, it's definitely a malicious attack at this point.
So you think these are bad at, like, these are...
Yeah. I mean, they hit it pretty well. I don't know if they hit it pretty well or I'm just too naive, but for...
I don't know how you could give your life to Bitcoin.
Their actions last year leave no doubt left.
And those actions to you were what? The
changes in Core 30.
The changes
actively Core 30. Making it easier to spam and making it a supported use case.
Okay. Because I know there's, you know, many people on... good people that I know on both sides of this equation that think, you know, that tend to agree with you. And then there's people I respect on the other side that agree more with Core. So, and I know those people aren't malicious people. Like, I know them personally. They just have a different opinion. Do you think that's a possibility here?
Not if they know the facts. No.
Not if they know the facts.
I mean, it was one thing when they just weren't updating the spam filters because... Mm-hmm. Like, you they had excuses like they didn't want to spend the time reviewing the code and stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's another thing to actively make it easier for the data storage and the spam when there's already filters that are working.
Interesting. 11 kids. So how many kids you have?
So far.
I've got 3. I'm about to have a third. So,
congrats.
Thank you, my man. How has being a father shaped how you are, who you are as a man?
I don't know.
You don't know? Is it tough with 11 kids? Like to?
No, there's only 8 at home at the moment.
Only 8 at home at the moment, yeah. It's tough for me with 2 right now. I don't know how you have...
Well, 2 is the hardest, so... Yeah. Some people say 3, but in my case, it was 2. Mm-hmm. So hopefully it'll get easier for you.
Yeah,
once this baby's born.
That's a pretty bullish action for the future. So you come off as a little pessimistic, but I think you're pretty bullish on the inside.
I think I tend to be more of a realist.
More of a realist? I don't know, man. 11 kids is like, I'm bullish on... That's a call option on the future, my man.
It's not a choice. But would I be working on Bitcoin if I was a pessimist?
That's a good point. I don't think so.
I'm just realistic. I see the risks, the chances, and I do my best to address the issues that we're facing.
No, I mean, I think it's really admirable how much you care about Bitcoin. And I think that it's important to have diverse viewpoints. And it's like, that's the whole point of open source projects, right? You've got everything out in the open and people can debate and have a discussion. And, you know, hopefully people are coming from the right point. They're like the right, their heart's in the right place, I guess, is what I'm getting at. You know, I hope you're wrong. I that would be very disappointing if, you know, people were actively trying to sabotage Bitcoin that were involved in the project. I mean, that doesn't make any sense why you would be involved in a project if you were actively trying to sabotage it. For what reason? So I'm hoping
you can't sabotage a project unless you get involved in it.
True. Well, I mean, there's been many people that have tried to sabotage Bitcoin over the years that have not been involved in it. So they've tried and they failed.
Fair.
I know plenty of them. Oh, let's see here.
That's probably why this ongoing attack from Core is probably the worst attack we've faced.
Paul wants me to ask you about Epstein's involvement in Bitcoin Core. Is that is there any merit to that? Jeffrey Epstein had indirect and financial ties to Bitcoin Core development through the donations to the MIT. Let's see. So this seems like a pretty, from what you're pointing at here, Paul, this seems like a pretty indirect thing. He gave to a college and the college gave to some kind of fund that then went around and funded some core developers. I don't think that's a direct thing, but maybe you have more knowledge on that.
I don't know anything about that.
I don't know anything about it either. That would be a spicy take. But
I mean, could it be true? Maybe. But do I know that it's true? No.
Well, did Peter Saddington say the other day? What was it? Maybe.
Just the reason I wanted it, you know, to be addressed is because it somewhat lends, you know, merit. It gives merit to the argument that Core may have been compromised, right? That there may be active sabotage, you know, in effect, and that there may be funding for that. So I just wanted to throw that out because that's a recent thing that's come around.
Yeah, I think it's first off, it's less than $1 million. And I don't think he gave it directly to, he didn't like give it directly to Bitcoin Core. It looks like he donated it to MIT and then MIT then turned around and
no such thing as giving directly to Bitcoin Core.
There's no such thing as giving directly to Bitcoin Core. Is that what you said? Can't you sponsor a developer and stuff like that?
That's through other organizations like this MIT.
Okay, I thought, wasn't this drama recently that MicroStrategy was like sponsoring Bitcoin Core devs, or wasn't that like a thing recently or a couple years ago?
MicroStrategy explicitly refused to fund any development.
Was it Cash App that did it? I feel like there was a couple companies recently that have.
Yeah, there was some like ETFs.
There were some companies that were actively sponsoring Bitcoin Core developers.
Yeah,
so.
I believe several ETFs announced that they were going to put a certain amount aside for developer funding. And then I guess Michael Saylor told one of the other ETFs, don't do that. And they didn't. And that was where the controversy came from.
Okay.
In hindsight, maybe he had good reason for that.
I don't usually talk to like super technical people. So this is a rare interview for me. So thank you for being patient with me and answering my questions and concerns and thoughts that I've come up with in my mind. And hopefully our audience gains more and more understanding from this conversation. Even if you're not technical, that would be my hope with this conversation. But I think one thing is for sure that, you know, there's a lot of people that care very much about Bitcoin. Do you have a final piece of advice or thoughts for anybody, new Bitcoiners, anybody that's getting involved with Bitcoin? Do you want to leave our audience with anything?
I guess just a reminder to run your own full node. At this point, make sure it's not.
Where's the best place for people to go to learn how to run their own full node? Would you just say a YouTube video? Is there a specific, do you have something on your website that's like a tutorial, a video, like a video tutorial, something along those lines?
Not really.
No.
I try to keep Bitcoin not as easy as possible to install on a computer. Obviously, there's Start9, Umbrella, whatever. Mm-hmm. It sells physical machines if you don't have a computer. Yeah, pretty much. The BitcoinKnots.org also has a link to, there's a Discord chat group. also a Telegram chat group and
okay.
where people discuss it. And
yeah, we'll put that link in this conversation.
They have like support groups there. Okay. Like if you need help with it, you can chat and just have to be aware that there's also scammers hanging out waiting try to scam people.
Yep.
Always on all these
platforms. No matter where you're at, there will always be scammers. So, you know, a fool and his money is soon parted. That's a lesson as old as time. And as much as you want to stop that, I mean, I think sometimes people just have to learn the hard way for the first time and they'll never happen to you again. It's like you pay for your education.
If you join and I DM you, it's a scammer.
Oh, man, that's funny. Well, Luke Dash Jr., thank you so much for this conversation.